Thank you, Yvette. Thank you. And hi, everybody, and welcome along to a class called Establishing a Daily Practice, which is one of the units of this Discovery Buddhism course. So, as you know, the structure is that we do a brief meditation at the beginning, we say some prayers, we take refuge, then the class will begin, and during the class there are periods for questioning and also for meditation. Let's begin. This requires that you become comfortable in your seat. Ideally, you should have your feet either like flat on the floor or a cushion. You want to have your back straight, shoulders relaxed. You place your hands in a comfortable position. And here you can meditate with your eyes open, closed, or partially closed. And then when you are sitting comfortably in your seat, just let your body breathe itself. While your body is breathing itself, become aware of the movements that take place and the feelings associated with those movements. And while you're sitting comfortably in your seat, imagine that in the space in front of you appears Shakyamuni Buddha. His body is made of golden light. He's sitting on a throne of light, and he's surrounded by your spiritual teachers, teachers of the lineage, other Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, and meditational deities. And also the Arahats and protectors. So in brief, there's many, many enlightened beings in front of you. And imagine that surrounding you are all sentient beings, which include your parents, family members, people you feel close to, others you want to be distant from, and many others that you feel strange towards or indifferent towards. But all of these people, just like ourselves, wish to avoid suffering. We wish to be happy. But equally, all of us lack genuine happiness. To achieve and abide within genuine happiness, we need to free ourselves from the causes of suffering, and these can be eliminated. Once we do this, the potential for genuine happiness arises. So we have this potential within all of us to be genuinely happy. This genuine happiness is often called an enlightened state of Buddhahood. The thing that you want to be more than just happy as an ordinary human being, you wish to generate the happiness of enlightenment. And this enlightenment is imbued with natural compassion. The wisdom is wide as the sky. And the skillful means to negotiate between the needs of all beings. The achievement of perfect wisdom, perfect compassion, and perfect power or ability has already been attained by the Buddha and his companions. So decide to rely upon them and their teachings, and they as a community, to develop your own wisdom, compassion, and skill. To affirm this, please join me in taking refuge in the three jewels and generating a mind of enlightenment. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. In response to this prayer of ours, imagine that lights and nectars stream forth from the heart of each enlightened being. They wash over you, and over all the people surrounding you. They're all obstacles and hindrances to your practice, vanish. And all your good qualities are revealed. And so you recollect the four immeasurable thoughts of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And start to establish all beings in those states. As a means of affirming this, we say, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. So again, lights of nectar spring forth from the heart of each enlightened being above you. And these pour over yourself and over everyone surrounding you. And all negativities and obstructions to good health, long life, realizations, these are all removed. And again, the natural potential for enlightenment is revealed. And you recollect the field of merit above you, and with faith and devotion, prepare yourself to accumulate merit, to increase that merit, and to remove any type of hindrance that will get in the way of that. So the Buddha and his companions reappear as a field of merit. And before them, you say, reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginningless time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. Now, to prevent ourselves from clinging to the practice we've so far done, imagine that your body, speech, and mind, your enjoyments, every object of the senses are utterly transformed within the wisdom realizing emptiness and reappear as a pure land which we're going to offer to the spiritual community. And we say, this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this as a Buddha field of offering. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. So we've released this offering, and the Buddha accepts it, and he smiles at us with delight. And we look up into his eyes. We reaffirm our wish to become enlightened. And feel accepted and at ease under the gaze of the Buddha. And then an emanation of the Buddha leaves his heart and moves through space and comes to the bottom of the crown of your head, facing in the same direction you are. Now the emanation begins to descend and down to the level of your heart, whereby it expands, filling your body and mind with lights and nectars. And these now pour out through the pores of the skin and begin to fill the 10 directions of space. And every being who exists within space finds themselves to now be within the enlightened state. I think I've accomplished the two purposes. And within that realization, you can hear the mantra of Shakyamuni Buddha resounding throughout space. When you join it, and you feel the resonance of it through your body and mind. Tayata Mahamune. So, Tayata Muni Muni Maha. Tayata Mahamunaya Soha. Just recite it a few times under the breath and feel its resonance. Tayata Om Muni Muni Maha Munaya Soha. Now the lights begin to recede from the 10 directions of space. They re-enter your heart. And now you feel yourself sitting on a seat. You feel yourself breathing, you can hear different sounds. You recognize that the meditation is one of imagination. Through this process, you've imprinted the mind with the conditions to bring about your enlightenment for the benefit of all beings. So rejoice in that. Desire to make this an actuality. And then breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through the mouth. Let your eyes flutter open when you're ready. Move your body in whichever way you'd like to, so you feel not comfortable but present. Okay, so today we're going to have a look at a very brief, just again to confirm some of the things we've been doing. We'll look again at the purification of speech. We're going to really focus on the seven limbs and the last two of the six practices of mandala and the requests. Now, to create the course, I've relied upon these books and others. Now, the material on the six preliminaries and the seven limbs, it's good explanations of it within this book called Steps on the Path to Enlightenment, Gradual Awakening, and Turning Confusion into Clarity. The other books, like this Geshe, Picture of His Holiness about the Mahamudra, Not for Happiness, and the two books down the middle, they're really about this practice of the mandala. And the mandala is an incredibly deep and varied practice, so we'll spend a little bit of time talking about that. Now, as you know, as we've been going through this course, we've been one of the major things we want to accomplish here is how to purify the speech. In brief, there are seven major steps, and these steps we break up into smaller parts too. But in brief, we start off with the emptiness meditation. And so we've been doing that like a few times here. I suggest a simple way of doing it is just ask yourself things like, who's breathing or who's sitting on the chair? You say, I am. And ask, is the body also there? And you go, yes. You say, am I the body? And it says, no. Why not? Because my identity is imputed to the body. But we can't find ourselves within any part of the body, and not a single part of the body is us. So that way we exist in relation to the body is through imputation. Just the name placed on that phenomena called the body. Yeah. We say, okay, so we're not the same as the body, but maybe we're inherently different. So you say, well, if I am inherently different, then that would mean there's no actual relationship between me and my body. So in fact, I could be off in the toilet, but my body could be here, understanding everything we know. No, it's not like that either. The conclusion is, I don't inherently exist. We are empty of that type of existence. Independence, so when you realize it, you go, I'm no longer going to impute my sense of identity to an ordinary body. It's full of suffering. It's its nature. If we do that, we suffer. They say, no, I'm going to impute my identity to wisdom that knows it's all empty, and this wisdom can appear as another deity, or just as the best version of yourself. And then we take the focus from there. Arises a deity or the body of light. And then on the tongue of ours, of course, is this syllable ah, turns into white moon, just representing the mind of a nightingale, or bodhicitta. And Ara is the arm, which represents form, body. So you see there's a relationship between mind and body. And also now comes the speech. White Sanskrit vowels, the red Sanskrit consonants, and the blue heart mantra depend origination. Light beams go out, they draw back all the power and blessings of the Buddhas and the enlightened beings. We recite the mantras three times each and carry out the visualization. Mantras all reabsorb and so forth. And we finish up with a blessing verse and we dedicate what we've done. When we actually do this, it doesn't take very long. You could probably easily do it in 6 minutes, eh? Easy. Once you just get the steps, you memorize the steps, you don't need the text, you can do it anyway. And like I said, it doesn't take very long.
Never timed it. I'll time it now.
Yeah, you'll see.
I think you do it in less than 6 minutes.
Yeah. And of course, the most important one is the emptiness part. Then we dedicate what we've done.
Apparently, there is a class of me doing Dharma in pajamas, leading the speech blessing. That's okay. On YouTube.
Okay, that's YouTube.
Yeah.
Dharma in pajamas.
Okay.
Yes. that's a good. That's right. Okay.
And that's also found on our website as in the resources section.
In the resources section.
Okay, so and today, what do? We're going to look at this. We're going to carry on about looking at these seven limbs. And the part sections we're going to focus on is the accumulation of merit, the purification, and the increase of merit. This is mainly what you're doing within this practice. These are the three things you're basically doing. Now, we covered three of them last week, didn't we? We started with prostration, then we looked at offerings, and then we looked at confession. So we'll take a look at the other four limbs today. Now here with this table, the first three, like I said, they're all in blue. It means we did that last week. Yeah. So the new ones, we're going to do other ones in color here. So as you can see, it's rejoicing, requesting teachings, requesting a teacher to remain, and then the dedication of practice. So briefly, just in briefly, you can see what each one is, what the function of each one is doing, and what it's an antidote to. So our first one, which we'll spend a bit of time on, is this rejoicing. But as you can see, its function is to feel happiness for the good deeds of all. And through doing this, we achieve the Sambhogakaya. It's called the body of bliss. Yeah. So when we look at what Buddhahood is, we say, okay, we're trying to achieve Buddhahood. Well, there are a number of different ways of looking at this Buddhahood. In the Mahayana tradition, it's the two bodies, or sometimes described as the three bodies, and sometimes described as the four bodies. It is not that we are going to become the historical personage of the Buddha who existed 2,500 years ago. So here, the way that Buddhahood is described is possessing a number of different bodies. And the first way is they just call it the two bodies, Dharmakaya and Rupakaya. So the Dharmakaya is referring to the mind of a Buddha. We need to have an enlightened mind. But what we do with emptiness, that correlates to that. All the other practices correlate to the rupakaya, the body of form. That's all the method side. Dharmakaya is wisdom, rupakaya is method. Now, at present, we are not quite a Buddha, but we've got everything there, haven't we? Because we've got a body and a mind. So we have bodies and mind, Buddha has body and mind. So we want to achieve this body called the Sambhogakaya, which is a form body, but it's the body that enlightened beings can engage with. So once we become enlightened, we have an enlightened body and an enlightened mind, and at the level of this enlightenment, we can converse with one another and understand each other. Ordinary people like ourselves, though, can't see these bodies. that they need to develop themselves until they actually can. So we can't naturally see them, but they know about us. So they can appear when all the conditions arise. And when they do, sometimes they often appear as what your Quran says, beautiful, enlightened bodies with all the ornaments and this sort of thing. Other practices, of course, they look very wrathful. But all you need to remember is that it's just the form of the body appearing. Now, like in our ordinary world, is it? You know, sometimes you can meet people that look really scary. But then when you get to know them, you realize they're really kind, nice people. This is the same idea of having the wrathful aspects of the deities. They look terrifying, but you have to remember there's no harm there. The harm that this produces is against the afflictions, not me and not ordinary people. So you never use these types of practices to hurt others. It's always to go against the afflictions. Here we have Nirmanakaya as another way, and then you move the bodies that can relate with us. So we have this holiness of the Nirmanakaya of compassion. So the rejoicing here is one of the causes for this enlightened body that deals with the sort of higher levels of the body sufferings and so forth. So I said the function is to feel happiness for the good deeds of all, and its target is jealousy or envy. But instead of envying the success of others, we adopt it as our own, and that way we get the same positive benefit. It's the simplest way of accumulating merit, but I'm still surprised at how many people won't do it.
How do we adopt the success of others?
By rejoicing in it, when we understand it. Wow, this person has done good, and then we rejoice, we get the benefit. Then we have requesting teachings and the request to remain. So requesting teachings, we have to ask the teachers to continue sharing wisdom. And what happens, one of the consequences of that is to achieve the Dharmakaya. So we definitely need to have, you know, we need the two, right? Dharmakaya and the Rupakaya. And the Rupakaya, Sambhoga and Nirmanakaya. There's just different ways of talking about bodies and wisdom and method. And its targeted obstacle here is ignorance. So it creates the karma cause to always have access to education and guidance. When we request the teacher to remain, its function is, you know, of course, we ask the guides not to pass away or leave. And this helps us achieve the speech of a Buddha. Its targeted obstacle is ingratitude and disrespect. And it ensures we value the presence of wisdom in the world. Finally, we have dedication. As you can see, its function is to direct the positive energy created during the sessions towards a specific goal. And in the Mahayana, the specific goal is the awakening of all beings. So whatever we're doing, we want to accomplish that. It targets wrong views and regretting positive things. It really seals the practice, so the energy cannot be destroyed by a moment of anger later on in the day. So that's it in brief. So now we'll have a little look at each one in detail. So we begin with rejoicing again. So just again, sum it up. The purpose of rejoicing is to weaken and purify our own jealousy, competitiveness, and envy. And this will happen as soon as we rejoice in any deed, any good deed, either enlightened beings or ordinary beings. And again, we reap the virtuous rewards of others' virtue. It's a tremendous decision. Now, how? Let's have a look at this. Rejoicing is a psychological technology that transmutes the virtue of others into one's own spiritual capital.
Whoa.
Whoa. Rejoicing is a psychological technology that transmutes the virtue of others into one's own spiritual capital. By generating sincere delight in the good deeds of others, the practitioner bypasses the heavy lifting of any physical action while still reaping the karmic rewards. The practice directly severs the root of jealousy, which is a state of mental poverty, and replaces it with a state of abundance. It is the most efficient way to accumulate merit for those with little time or energy. So then it asks those questions, so how does this work? And I haven't actually done anything myself other than just feel happy. Well, the Lam Rim explains that karma or action is primarily mental intention. When you rejoice, your mind completely aligns with the virtuous motivations of the person performing the good deed. Because your mind approves and takes delight in that virtue, you collect a share of the result. So if the person you rejoice in has a lower level of realization than you, you gain more merit than they do. Isn't that great? So there's got to be a lot of people like that. They're just ordinary people doing good, and we can rejoice in it. So in fact, we gain more than they actually are doing it themselves. If they are equal to us, we gain equal merit. But if they are a Buddha or a high-level being, meaning a bodhisattva or an arahant, we gain a portion of their vast merit. If they're greater than us, portion, same with us, equal, less than us, we get greater. So as an analogy, rejoicing is like being a shareholder in a successful company. When you not show up to the factory to build the products, the actual good deed, but because we invested our capital, which is our attention and approval, in that company, we receive the dividends, just as if we'd done the work.
Like, I saw that as like a mathematical equation, what you're saying. If you rejoice in the merit of someone who's less, whatever the word was, you know, so if you look at it like it's a mathematical equation, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, yes, it does.
You know what I mean? Like, I see karma as very mathematical. Like, there's no failing in it.
No, it's just, yeah, it's... Yeah, it's cause and effect, is it?
Cause and effect,
this leads to the next thing.
You make it sound easier, but we're living in a very competitive, envious society, so it's probably nowhere near as easy as you.
Oh, no, I think it makes it even easier. It's better, because if it's so competitive and they're better than us, fantastic. You succeeded, I rejoice. Every time we're the less, we get a chance to rejoice. We can't lose here. The only way we can lose is to be jealous or to, you just don't like other people, envious. You don't like people succeeding.
Resentful.
The sort of thing where there's so much good going on in the world and you go, yeah, but what about the bad? We don't even sit there to take a moment to go, thank goodness that's happening.
Yeah, well, probably if we're dwelling on the bad, I mean, we can see the kind of investment that is because it just ruins our day, and that's the minimum.
Yeah, which is very
all
easy.
Of our negativities.
Yeah, it's like you're saying, Sally, this is the math, right? You focus on what doesn't work, the negative side, what do we get?
Actually, so it's interesting you said about the math, because in Bendigo, when Lamso Rinpoche was leading one of the retreats, he spent a long time on the mats. So, when you rejoice in the merit of bodhisattvas, then you get, people with more realizations than you get half of their merit. And I think it was like with the Buddhas, if you rejoice in the merit of the Buddhas, then you get one-tenth of the Buddha's merit. So think about that. Like, so all you have to do is just daydream about all the wonderful things that the Buddha did, and you're getting a tenth of the Buddha's merit.
So as an exercise, you said, identify a rival or someone you envy. Each day, find one small thing they did well, even if it was just dressing well or speaking clearly, and mentally say to yourself, how wonderful, may their success increase. There's no need to be resentful for somebody who's abusing us, none at all. If we say that we hurt, then Whenever anyone abuses and we hurt, that's the part we play. We bring something into it. It's never just them doing stuff to us. But in fact, one of the things we need to learn very quickly is to identify ourselves as one of the true sufferings. So the analogy that they give to this is that when we appropriate this body and mind to be ours or mine, it's like appropriating a wound and going out into the world as an open wound. Now, if you are hurt, well, that's, of course you're going to be hurt. You're an open wound. Anything's going to hurt you. So we can't just keep saying, like you hurt me. It's like, well, I've got a body that hurts. Who should I blame, you or me? You know, if I didn't have a body that hurt and you said what you did to me, no problem, would it?
Yeah, sometimes just be the air that
just
hurts.
Just be air moving, your mouth going up and down and going, man, I've got no problem with what you've got to say. Why? Because I don't actually have the cause and conditions to hurt. But if I have them, I'm going to hurt. And so when somebody like does that and you do hurt, you go, thanks for reminding me. I'm a part of true sufferings. You're right. I forgot. I thought I was actually okay. You were the problem. But no, I'm part of the problem. And the great thing is both of us can be part of the solution. Now, like you say, the person who might have harmed us, we could still rejoice that they're alive and they've been able to do this. And depends upon that, I could remind myself of true sufferings and generate compassion towards you because you've helped me. But by me being here and you hurting me, you've hurt yourself. Anyway, there's lots of interesting ways to sort of think about this. So I'm a person who doesn't like somebody else. And so then I just pointed out some of the good things this other person was doing. And so I said, instead of every time you put your mind on the person and think about all the reasons you don't like them, why don't you put your mind on them and find one or two reasons to like them? Because there's nobody that exists who's all bad. Well, as far as we know, it's the sentient beings all good. That's that name all good is for the Buddhas. But for sentient beings, they're not all good and they're not all bad. So when we see them in the bad light, you've got to remember it won't affect them at all. What it does, it affects you. So we are the ones who we hurt ourselves in this way. We add to the true sufferings. So I'm saying this, I've just been reading a marvelous book called Patience by Lama Zopa Rinpoche. I've never come across what he's saying in that book and in any other book. And I don't know, something must have fallen into place and it sort of makes a lot more sense to me. But in this book, of course, is this idea of like rejoicing. So always try to find, you heard that story about the two guys who were in the jail cell and it was just full of horse manure. And one guy just couldn't bear the smell of it and was just really going crazy. And the other guy was really happy digging away. And the guy says, what's so great about being here? And he goes, you know, he says, well, he says, with this much crap in here, there must be a great horse. So he's, you know, good idea. Yeah, so find ways to, what is it, be happy. What's that, remember that song many years ago? Finding all the ways to be happy? Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. Well, this is good advice. So let's move next to the next one, which is called these requests to teach. The idea here behind this, if we do this, it counteracts the abandonment of Dharma. And finally, it also creates causes for receiving future teachings.
What is the abandonment of Dharma?
Well, so there's a number of different ways you can abandon Dharma. The most, in fact, Geshe once said it's near impossible to abandon Dharma. So again, Dharma has many different meanings. So one of the ways you can abandon Dharma is just don't believe in internal cause and effect. But then, yeah, that Dharma is just basically cause and effect. This is the teaching of the Buddha. The Buddha says, if you want to take refuge in me, adopt the teachings of cause and effect. And this is how it all works. If you don't do that, well, you're not going to get out. You're stuck. Again, another way of like the Dharma, what was it? They said, let's get a really simple one. Do no harm, do good, examine the mind. So if you think, okay, I'm not gonna examine my mind, I'm not gonna do good, I'm gonna do whatever I want to. You say, well, that's another way of abandoning Dharma. Yes, when I got this, when I was reading this material and started thinking about it, you know, in terms of the Four Noble Truths, there's a section called True Sufferings. And this is where they have the analogy of like looking at yourself as being like an open wound. So the first, so if you take that idea, what's the first thing to do with that knowledge? And the answer is, don't hurt yourself anymore. Like you already, like it's sore enough, right? It's bad enough. So the way you hurt yourself is through your thinking, your speaking, and your behavior. And that's why it just starts with the idea of just restrain yourself from adding more suffering to what you're already going through. Let's just start there. And when you get, when that's sort of settled down, then you can say, okay, now what do I actually, what else can I do? Well, now start doing the opposites of those things that you did to cause yourself more harm. So how do we understand this? So he says, first of all, you must verbally or mentally ask a teacher to explain the topic. This action creates the cause and effect link necessary for the wisdom to be communicated. I was thinking, the action creates the cause and effect link necessary for wisdom to be communicated. Before, must verbally or mentally ask a teacher. So we've had plenty of times, haven't we, Miffy? These people are sitting here with a question, and they come in and it gets answered. And it's like they have, come in with a problem and that's exactly what the teacher talks about. Or other times, which has happened, like Lama Zofa and Geshe Tashi Seri too, you come in and then he starts talking about something like, what's this got to do with anything here? And the other guy, it's got to do with something that's going on here. Somebody needs to hear this. So yes, so many years ago, remember that time, Miffy, where the student was able to, she was doing like fortune reading or something. She was doing some sort of thing. She was able to, when you're going to get your cards read or your hands read or something like that. This woman had this talent for doing it. And then she came to the classes only a couple of times, but then her burning question was, should I be taking money for this? And guess we start off about teaching, isn't it? But we're off about 20 minutes. We're looking over, like, what's this got to do with us? That one woman sitting there, this is all for her. Now, so this is a good thing. Like you come in, if you have a burning issue, like either raise your hand or try to communicate it some way.
So when we're in teachings, if we just manage to formulate a question, then it kind of gets communicated telepathically. But also with requests, if we're there to receive vows, like refuge vows or bodhisattva vows, that's like something where we actually have to verbalize it. So we have to actually verbalize the request as well. And again, I remember one time in Bendigo where Rinpoche was going to give refuge in the lay vows, and he asked everybody, "Oh, we're kind of running out of time. Do you want to do the vows now or after lunch?" And everyone went, "Oh, after lunch," except for a few people that said, "Oh, no, we really want them now because a couple had to leave or whatever." Mm-hmm. So actually, just like on that picture there, there were five people that stayed and missed their lunch and took the refuge vows, and they came right up to around Rinpoche, huddled around him like the first five disciples. And then, of course, after lunch, Rinpoche's like, "No, we're not doing refuge anymore." And that was it. Everybody else made their choice. What do you want, refuge or lunch? And just under 200 people said lunch.
Yeah, these are Buddhists. There's some funny things like that happen, and a little bit.
And it was really to do with like body and speech. You had to demonstrate with the request. You couldn't just have it as a nice idea.
Well, just like turn up.
I'm like the present.
Yeah.
This is a present. You never know.
You never know.
So applying this sort of works against the arrogance of thinking we already know enough, and it cultivates a mind that values instruction when we make this type of request. And it realizes, this is another thing, you have to realize that the teacher and the student are interdependent. One cannot exist without the other. So we don't make the request to a teacher, we won't actually have a teacher to teach. So they need us, we need them. And this is the way of having the relationship is through the request. You look at the beseeching prayers. So the idea here is to purify any types of harm or disrespect that we have towards the teacher, either in this life or in past lives. And of course, the great benefit of it is that you actually do find you're guided by them.
So what are we beseeching?
Now, this is the practice of requesting the Buddhas and teachers not to pass away into the state of peace. So this is a direct antidote to wrong views regarding the nature of the teacher in particular. By formally requesting it to stay, the practitioner acknowledges that the teacher's physical form is impermanent and subject to the laws of cause and effect. It establishes the student's role as the active sustainer of the spiritual relationship. So this is the analogy is, imagine a radio station that broadcasts 24 hours a day. But if your radio is turned off or it's broken, well, then you're not going to hear the music. The broadcaster cannot force the music into your room or into your car. Yeah? Requesting the teacher to remain is the act of sort of repairing the radio and turning the volume up. So when I read this, I thought, wow, this is like copying it big in a car. And we know, you know, you just got to turn the radio on. And there's all sorts of things you can hear on the radio, isn't there? But if you don't turn it on, you're not going to get any of it. So this is the idea of like this beseeching prayer. Asking the teacher to live a long life, it creates the karmic causes to avoid being born in a time or a place where there are no teachings. It creates a sense of urgency and appreciation for the resources we have right now. But ultimately, we have to realize that teacher is the wisdom of your own mind. So sustaining an actual, you know, living being as a teacher sustains your own awareness. And then we come to our dedication. Again, this is what it does. It purifies wrong views and anger and makes sure that the merit is never lost, but ripens accordingly. So, you know, we do, I'm sure there's a lot of good we do in the world. Whenever these, you know, we've got to direct it towards the good. Because very easy to get swept away, you know, like you're saying, there's a lot of influences in the world that can shape our mind very quickly, turn from a positive state to a negative state. So once you've created something positive, you know, remind yourself, oh God, great, rejoice, dedicate. So the scale of it, so the scale of a result is determined not by the physical size of the action, but by the vastness of the intention. A small act of kindness, if not dedicated, yields a limited result that ends once enjoyed. However, that same small act, when dedicated to the welfare of all beings, connects with an infinite object, all living beings, thereby making the result infinite and inexhaustible. And by analogy, consider a single drop of water. If you place it on a rock under the hot sun, it will evaporate and disappear within minutes. However, if you take that same drop and pour it into the ocean, it becomes indistinguishable from the ocean itself. It doesn't dry up until the ocean dries up. So here we go. I'm going to slip this with the wisdom, with all the enlightened beings. I'm going to go with that status. So we now come to our anything here you would like to ask and find interesting. Notice this is I'm going through it quite quickly, and you know there's all these lists in there and so forth. So was it what we've gone through four? Is it four things here? Isn't it? What was the first one?
Rejoicing.
Right. That's it. Yeah. That's it. The easiest one of all. This is what we can do all the time.
Oh, Angela has a question here. When someone expresses jealousy, when you're fully expecting them to rejoice at something that's happened to you, how yeah. best to respond? So it's like the envy of somebody else.
Well, interesting. I'm so glad you're still alive. I can rejoice on that.
No, when you expect someone to rejoice something that's great that's happened to you.
And they don't.
Yeah.
And
they're envious of you.
Okay, so the other person's envious of you.
Yeah.
So I'm not quite sure I understand it right. So what I'm hearing you say is, what do I do with my own mind when the other person responds in this way? But is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Are you asking me?
Yeah.
Well, I said, I'm so grateful that you're still alive and you can express an opinion at all. Yeah, so no, for me, when I wake up in the morning, the first thing I'm grateful for is to be alive. It's as simple as that. I'm so glad to be alive. So you could rejoice right there, right? That this person that you have this expectation to wasn't met. You go, thank goodness you showed me that. These expectations I have are just that. They're not the reality. But I've made a mistake. You pointed it out. Thank you. No, I don't think you need to. You don't need to make it. No, because the person is not the person, the antagonist, the way they behave is just the behavior. The person is fine. The person has Buddha nature. This is wonderful to rejoice in. The behavior is the four, yes. They should be, you know, like if. Now we could look at them and go, well, that's a behavior I don't need to engage in. Thank you for pointing that out to me. Yeah, and then if you had that, and then you could go from empathy to compassion to joy, because suffering doesn't truly exist. It can all be overcome.
Also, people are often envious because someone else's virtue feels like having your own nose rubbed in it.
Yeah.
And so they're disassociated from their own virtues. So if you can point out their good qualities that they can't even see, because
it's that work thing.
I think you're right, though. It's your problem. It's your expectation. You've got this expectation, and there's the reality over there. I mean, yeah, that's on you.
That's right. Feeling there. Yeah. So a person here, Angela, could show us that, what is this the same thing? The root of all problems is.
Assumption,
making this assumption that it's going to be like this.
It's also pride as well, like I've done something really good, I'm expecting to get out of heaven back for that.
Yeah. Yes, others, like one of the things that others' bad behaviors show us what not to do. Which, yeah, that's a great thing to know, is that we don't have to go through it ourselves, do we? We don't need to. And yeah, there's this sort of thing at the same time, like, oh, great, that's what I don't need to do. And then comes the compassion. But through your showing me, you suffer. You're creating this suffering. So this is where the compassion would come in. Yeah? But what you've actually done for me is great. Thank you very much. What you've done to yourself is terrible.
Also remember Lamso Rinpoche saying about keeping your own spiritual practices and realizations and successes really private, because that there's nothing like spiritual success to engender envy. And so for the to save others from themselves, you keep it all under your hat.
Okay, let's do our first meditation, folks. Adjust the posture if you're quite comfortable getting in your seat. just relax your shoulders. Let the body sort of drop down onto the seat and let the body breathe itself. Let's create an altruistic motivation to engage in the meditation. We wish to fuel our own potential to bring lasting happiness to all beings. So how can we multiply our merit without performing any physical labor ourselves? So rejoicing in others' goodness grants us their potential by simply appreciating their virtuous deeds. This is like a merchant's assistant who gains profit just by being present. Now, how can we transform a passive wish into an active state of receptivity for inspiration? How can we transform a passive wish into an active state of receptivity for inspiration? By requesting teachings, it warms up the mind. It opens us to receive the powerful broadcast signal of the lineage. As a present, our mind is like a frozen radio that has to be warmed up to receive the music. Or the good news. So what specific mechanism prevents our virtue from being exhausted by temporary worldly pleasures? So what specific mechanism prevents our virtue from being exhausted by the eight worldly concerns? So dedication directs the merit towards enlightenment, making its power inexhaustible until we reach that goal. And this is very much like a drop of water that will never dry up once it's merged into the ocean. It will only dry once the ocean itself is dry. So today, just try to steer your mind towards others' benefit, especially after any small act of kindness. And the rest of the conference, your efforts are sealed and protected to bring about the welfare of yourself and all beings. And then breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through the mouth. So now we can look at the mandala. So what is it? What is the mandala? So we're going to start off just with saying like sort of what it is, and then we'll sort of look at its function and other things about it. So basically, mandala means that which circles about its center. That's the meaning of it. And another meaning of it is absorbing the essence. So a mandala offering is a sophisticated visualization method used to accumulate the vast and positive potential. By mentally constructing the entire universe, which is symbolized by Mount Meru, the continents and the celestial bodies, the sun and moon, and transforming it into a perfected realm, the practitioner counters attachment. It's really, you know, like you said, when you think about this, we have these eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, mind, six senses. They engage with a phenomenon we call the world. And when these senses come to objects they like, this liking is mixed up with attachment, because all the objects have an existence or appear to have an existence they don't have. But so senses go like that, lamb on it in the mind of ignorance, grasps at it and holds on to it. We don't want to let it go. Now, the greatest attachment we have is to this body. If you've ever sat with people who are dying and have a transfer of the body, it's not a pleasant experience. It's a little frightening. Not so much for us if we have a background in Buddhism, but for the person dying and especially for their family. So this is the way, like giving away the body before we die, so that when we do die, we just sort of go. We've had lots of practice of letting go. The value of the offering is not in the material object, but in the scope of the visualization. This is interesting. The mind cannot distinguish between a vividly imagined universe and a real one. And this, you know, in terms of the benefit that we can create for ourselves. Just practicing the seven limbs without the mandala offering is like preparing the field but never planting the seeds. Prostration and confession clear the rocks and the weeds, but the mandala offering plants the high yield seeds that will ripen into spiritual realization. Now, when Lama Sol Kapa prepared himself to get the direct realization of emptiness, he did 3.5 million mandala offerings, and not all the skin offers. Because they didn't carry little things that we've got around, right? They just grab whatever's necessary. So you could pick up a rock and just go, this rock is the whole universe, symbolizes the universe. And then you've got this rubbing thing that you see you doing it, and of course you rub the skin off your arms. And of course that doesn't happen to us because we've got lovely instruments to do. Yeah, during this retreat, you performed so many mandala offerings, skin on his forearms was rubbed raw, and he had to use the back of his arm to continue. He did not stop until he had a direct vision of the masters of the lineage. And that's exactly what happened. They kept offering the universe to the deities, and then they appeared. Which was a really amazing story about the show. Because before he did it, he couldn't do it, right? He could not have a conversation with Manjushri, the actual personification of Buddhist wisdom. So he had to get somebody else to do it. So what he would do, the other person would do it, and then Lama Sol Kapa would ask the other person. The other person acted as a medium between the field of enlightenment, and then the answers would come back and he'd tell Lama Sol Kapa. And he says to him, you can do this. Why don't you do it? And so then, like Lama Sol Kapa started to do the practice himself, and finally he had direct, Manjushri appeared to him directly and told him, this is if you want to realize emptiness, this is what you have to do. Because he had this idea of what emptiness was, and he needed to know, am I right? And there was no one there at the time that he could check with. He was doing something a little different. And so he checked, and Manjushri was, no, you haven't got it yet. You need to do this. You need to do these three things. And Lama Sol Kapa did that, and then finally, of course, he got the correct thing. But in the text was great because he's got his text here in front of him, and he comes up with questions in it. And so the story of it, like he's like that. And then the shadow of Manjushri fell across the page. Honestly, I think it gives me the goosebumps. I was like, Jesus, okay. You know, it's not like there's nothing there.
It's like Elvis is in the building.
Yeah, that's right. He just cast the shadow over the listeners, over the audience. Yeah, Elvis is in the building. Yeah, so it's a bit, I get the little goosebumps reading those sort of stories. So how does it work? Basically, you know, you have a round metal plate or you have a basis of something, you place different things on it and you recite the words. The items represent the total sensory experience of the universe. But because, you know, why is it? Because of the objects we become attached to. Psychological, training the mind to let go of attachment and to feel abundance. Realize that the giver, the gift, and the receiver are all empty of inherent existence. That's the ultimate one. So here, as you know, this is the verse, right? This ground and anointed with perfume. You said this, you know, as we began the class, didn't we? So this ground and anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, this represents the golden ground. Mentally, you're cleaning the space of your mind. The perfume represents moral discipline, and the flowers represent the beauty of virtue. You're not offering a dirty or an ordinary world, but one you've actively purified. Adorned with Mount Mary, four consorts, the sun and the moon. Mount Mary is the center of stability. The four continents represent all inhabited worlds. The sun and moon represent the illumination of wisdom and method. You are mentally claiming ownership of the entire cosmos. Now, these mandalas, there are a number of different types. Well, there's lots of ways you can do it. But the way I want to say here, there are what they call the outer mandala. So this is the idea of the outer mandala is the one we recite here. This ground, anointed with perfume. Although the verse, the words stay the same, the way you can approach it is on different levels. You can approach this inner mandala, outer secret suchness. There are different levels of understanding of what's going on here. Now, does such a place like actually exist when you read? You know, when you read the thing, it says, this ground and all the flowers, and all at Mount Mary. So Mount Mary is seen as the mountain at the center of the universe. Does such a mountain exist?
Well, as Holiness said, no.
Well, instead of saying it depends, isn't it? But it doesn't literally exist. Like science, we're out there, we're going to stick all the telescopes out there, yeah, we're not going to find Mount Meru. So we cannot take this to be literally true. And that's what he's trying to say. Don't, that's just another way of attachment, isn't it? Grasping at things are going to, no, it is like this because he said it or he said that. In fact, one of those books that I showed you, I really like it because it shows you all these different ways of looking at world systems, how worlds exist. It's a bit like looking at, let's look at it through the lens of chemistry, biology, whatever. You just look at it and you can explain the world through that lens. So this is a lens that's been built up to make everything look not ordinary like this, but absolutely splendid and wonderful, and say, here you go, not mine. So it creates something wonderful and we let it go. And in a way, you can say, like, we've created this wonderful life, and we're going to leave it. And there's nothing we can take with it, with us. But so let's not, you know, grab and hold on to what we can't take with us. I love those stories though when sometimes when people are dying, the dying person says the real smart thing to the living person, which was like, I'm going to be all right. Or the living person says to the dying person, don't worry, Mum. Everything's going to be all right. And it's like sort of saying, drop your worries, Mum. You can go. Well, it's okay to go now. Nothing to worry about. And if you've ever been with people dying and you come out later and you're there, it's the strangest thing, isn't it? Because the world just keeps on rolling. The people are gone. It's just like, oh, no, it's just the way it is. Yes, so to overestimate and think more, no, just let it go. So this leads us, of course, to this idea of science versus literalism. The conflict between the flat Earth mandala cosmology and Western science is resolved by understanding the distinct functions. So science describes the conventional physical nature of the universe, and the mandala practice utilizes a symbolic, idealized universe to train the mind in generosity and release. They harmonize in the view that reality is not fixed, but is participatory constructed by the observer. So this is another great thing to remember. Like, we are embedded, this thing we call the world, it's not us here and the world there. We're embedded deeply in it. So imagine that this is like, this container is the world, right? So in here is a little bit of water. And it's sort of like, instead of the water being in here, we're in here. We are in the world, like the water is in the cup. But in fact, This whole thing called the world, that's us. We're not separated from it. This is what it's sort of meant. There is no line between us and the world. That's the line is that was a conceptual idea. It's an idea. That's the line, conception.
Or even just the technology of the body. So we see a particular spectrum of colours and other creatures, because they have different eyes, see a whole different other spectrum of colours, and the ones we see don't exist for them.
So this shows us there's no separate objective world apart from us. The world is interdependent. It depends upon us to see it the way we do. It depends upon, you know, the world or any insect or any other animal. The way it appears to them is dependent upon their biology, isn't it? Just like us. So it's not this it's an illusion that we're separate from. The fact that in the, as a philosopher, Kierkegaard showed that this is a complete fallacy for us to be separate from the world.
So in a way, we're putting on the Buddha's eyes to see the world.
Yeah.
And that's the mandala.
Yeah. The Dalai Lama has explicitly stated that if scientific analysis proves a Buddhist scriptural assertion wrong, such as the size of the moon or the shape of the earth or so forth, Buddhism must accept the scientific fact. This shows that the truth of the mandala lies in its transformative power, not its geography. So I was interested in the geography. We're not interested in that. We're interested in what does it do to my mind? And I can imagine something beautiful and just letting it go, not holding on to it. A student once asked a teacher, if the world is round, why do we offer a flat mandala? And the teacher said, when you offer a gift to a king, do you wrap it in an old dirty newspaper or in beautiful silk? See, the round earth is the dirty newspaper of our ordinary karma. The mandala is the beautiful silk of our pure imagination. We offer the best version of the world and not the ordinary one. So this is our next meditation. So this one is a little different, but it's a way of looking, it's another again, the mandala. I'm sitting, your back is straight, your shoulders relaxed. Yourself breathe normally and naturally. I think that you're going to offer a mandala. So imagine that your very own skin becomes the surface of a golden ground. And your blood becomes an ocean of nectar. Your flesh becomes beautiful garlands of flowers that are floating on that ocean of nectar. Your stomach becomes Mount Meru. Your hands and feet become the four worlds. The upper and lower parts of your arms and legs become the eight subcontinents. And your head becomes the beautiful palace on top of Mount Meru. Now your heart becomes a beautiful jewel adorning the top of this palace, and your eyes become the sun and moon. And all of your inner organs become wonderful possessions and enjoyments of gods and humans. So let go of this phenomenon called body and world. Give it away to all the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, all the enlightened beings. This is the universe purified. And now breathing in through your nostrils, exhale. I was wondering, do we have that golden prayer book with the inner mandala on it? I really like this one here too. Let's find that women are offering. If you have some, yes, have you have any questions at all about this one? If you're looking
through, in terms of our daily practice, is this just a visualization practice that you do?
It depends. So, yeah, you could do it like this, put your hands together like this. So you've got the physical representation, you know, like this, and you go, okay, so when you do it like this, you've got these two fingers here called Mount Meru in the middle. You could think of that as being like your spine. And then the four cons being your arms and legs, what they call the sun and the moon, those your eyes. There's quite a few different ways you could do this. I think many of the deity practices, the highest deity practices, mandala offerings can be quite specific to that deity. So, you know, it's like you're offering up. It means you get an enlightened being and you're imagining you're enlightened man. Yes, this is the one. This one I want to thank you with. So here is a lovely mandala offering. It's called the inner mandala offering. It says, the optics of my attachment, aversion and ignorance, friends, enemies and strangers, and my body, wealth and enjoyments. So these are all the objects of attachment, aversion and ignorance, friends, enemies, strangers, my body, wealth and enjoyments. Without any sense of loss, I offer this collection. Please accept it with pleasure and bless me with freedom from the three poisons. It was crazy, like the objects of my attachment, aversion, ignorance, blah, blah, blah. Like, you're saying, I'm not going to hold on to any of it.
So you can release,
I didn't release
your
it.
Attachments, your resentments.
Yeah, that's right. That's the part I really like. Hey? All this, I thought, wow, we've got all this stuff we not really good for us. Yeah, we just go, well, it all relates to my friends, strangers, or enemies, or my own body and things that I like. That's where it's all coming up, but I'm going to let it go now. Like I can offer it to you, but like transformed. You know, you should say all this. You know, the lovely thing about this and why it works is because things don't have any intrinsic nature, because they're all dependent arising and especially dependent upon consciousness and language. So nothing is really, nothing truly exists. Therefore, we can do all this and it'll work.
And also, those things won't harm the Buddha.
Nothing can harm the enlightened mind. That's right. And in fact, what's even really interesting too is if you really look for these things to truly exist, you won't find any of them. So, how do they exist? In mere name. So, then why not imagine the very best things you can imagine and put, they exist in mere name, but they do exist. So I'm going to let them go now and just return back to the original nature. In a way, I just think when I was saying, I think, you know, sometimes you have really good dreams and you have really bad dreams. Right? But whatever type of dream you have, you need to have a screen to put it on, right? And the screen's always there. But the movies, they come and go. Right? So in fact, we're okay all the way. It's just saying, look, don't grab onto the bad movies and think, you know, get freaked out by it. And don't grab onto the really good ones either and go overboard. And don't get really bored just because it's not a movie you particularly like. So all that stuff, the boredom, the attachment and the aversion, they're going to come and go. But what remains is what we call, you know, the screen that it plays up against. And this is this, you know, subtle mind. If its nature is not recognized, we call it samsara. We recognize it's called nirvana. Now, nirvana is just the absence of all that stuff in the clutching it. Samsara is like when we grab at the images to be real. Right? And nirvana, as we know, they're just images that we don't grab. Nirvana's got the two aspects. One is that no images whatsoever appear. And then the other thing is that and we don't grab. And so, you know, whatever the appearances are, they're not really the problem. What the problem is the grabbing at them and holding them to be true. That's where we go wrong, you know, and things get out of hand. It's like that way when you would have seen this happen yourself. Anybody taken a little child to the movies and they got really scared? You know, they do, right? I mean, we would have got scared too of some of the things up on the big screen, right? Because we think it's true. Yeah. But the parents sitting beside us, they know it's not true. They said, Sarah's not believing it's true and latching on. And the mother's going, yeah, it's all happening. It's not true. Like, I'm not upset. There's an analogy, it's like that. But of course, even when we're adults, so don't we? We like to go along to the movies and, be scared or have something happen, right? Because at some stage, your mind's actually grabbing at it and it's just like real. That's a good movie. Anyway, let's move on. We've got the prayer of the three great purposes, and I think the requesting prayer to go.
7 minutes.
Yep, okay, thank you, Vicky. So, three great purposes, the three great purposes. So, here are the three great purposes. Please help me stop wrong ideas. Help me actualize the right ideas. And look, help me get rid of all the obstacles that appear between these two so they'll make it as difficult for me. Yes, it's the wrong ideas that create the attachment, the aversion. Get like the right ideas. These phenomena don't truly exist. They're dependent upon their parts and labels. And meanwhile, we will meet up with obstacles through our practice. That is for sure. So we're going to have to do something about that, recognize them when they come up. Some of it's really dullness, some of it's just aversion. You just don't want to do this anymore. It does happen. The stuff will happen, and we've got to need to know what to do. So, when these obstacles come up, the idea is to do purification practice. Now, the prayer of the three great purposes is a specific request made to the spiritual mentors and the holy beings of the lineage that occurs immediately after making the mandala offering, and it asks for these three specific things. So why do we do this? According to the Lama Tsongkhapa and the Great Treatise, accumulating positive energy or merit through offerings is not enough. We must direct that energy. So this prayer functions as a sort of dedication vow. It ensures the energy created by our practice does not go to waste or result in worldly wealth. Instead, it transforms the energy into progress. So literally, we're making a quest to stop bad thoughts, start good thoughts, and remove problems. It's simply said.
I think one of the biggest obstacles is that grasping.
Massive grasping and the clinging. Yeah, and it's a good idea to make that clear to yourself. Then we finish up with this requesting prayer, and here we're sort of seeking inspiration to ripen a realization we might have. So the requesting prayer is the culmination of all the preparatory rites, the five other things that came before this. Having accumulated positive energy or the merit and purified the negative energy, the student now fervently calls upon the lineage of teachers to transform the mind. So this acts as a bridge between the preliminary rituals and the actual meditation. So you go through your sadhana, you'll see this, and then pretty much really quickly after it, they do the whole Lam Rim prayer, at least in our tradition. It's like, right, I've got the mind ready to take it all in. Now I'm going to take it all in. And you do it in some sort of really brief way, like the 14 verses of Foundation of All Good Qualities, or Three Principal Aspects, or even Parting from the Four Attachments. Just find something that sums everything up. It's not too long for us, right? So we don't get too tired. It's just, okay, this is enough. Like you might say, like I like, is this one of them? If I have attachment to the world, I'm not a spiritual person. Right? There's four sort of things you go through. If I have attachment to this, I don't have renunciation. If I have attachment to this, I don't have bodhicitta. If I think like this, I don't have the right view. Right? So it's a lovely, really quick way of putting the whole lot into your mind stream and go, okay, this is, I've got the whole path in here. Now I need to concentrate on a specific aspect of it, and I'll do that next. The prayer operates on the principle of dependent arising. So realizations do not arise from nowhere. They arise from the meeting of a prepared mind, us as the student, and a powerful influence, the teacher or the lineage. The request in prayer is the act of making that meeting happen. A student once asked the master, "I study the text, but my mind does not change. Why?" And the master replies, "You're like a man dying of thirst by a river, waiting for the water to jump into his mouth. You must cup your hands and drink." So the request in prayer is the act of cupping one's hands. It turns a passive wish into an active reception. So literally, we're asking our teachers to grant specific spiritual abilities, but basically it's a psychological method to reduce our pride and to increase our receptivity. Realizing that the teacher and your own mind are not separate. You are requesting your own future enlightened nature to manifest. Well, we do. You might have some questions, but we can't answer them. You've got 1 minute. Is there any questions you'd like to ask? Because this is actually, we've got to the end now. There's no other meditation. So as you can see, we did a lot, right? Even if we just covered four things here. So basically over the last, I think, 3 weeks, we've looked at the six preliminary practices, and within those preliminary practices were the seven limbs. Last week we did three of the seven limbs, and today we did the other four. So that's the end of our class for today. I was trying to find something you can take away. I think that the best one, take the easiest, rejoice. It makes a big difference to your life. Okay, so our takeaway. We know the final four of those seven limbs of practice and the last two of the six preparatory practices. You see these again and again throughout the sadhanas and practice stuff. Sometimes they leave things out, they make it smaller. Other times they enlarge it and you get a whole lot of other stuff. You've got to find something that'll work for you. And I think Lama Zopa Rinpoche put together a little practice manual on Shakyamuni Buddha and how to take an ordinary life of suffering and turn it into ultimate happiness. These are just ways of trying to work with this material.
And a lot of the preachers are based on the seven limbs. They're just an extended version of seven those seven, and you can recognize them as we go through.
So next week, class seven, isn't it? Next week.
Yep.
So please keep going with what you do have with this speech blessing. Try and become comfortable with that.
Sorry, Demi just thought that next week was the review class, but it's not. It's class seven. That's so right. We've got several more weeks. But if you want to bring lunch to share anyway, yes, you can.
And so it's class seven, then.
Then review.
Because I thought I've done them. I'm sort of way on the track of doing it. I've gone, oh my gosh, what's happened to me?
Angela also says, I'm surprised every week. It's great.
Yeah, so anyway, we've got a class ready for next week. We'll show how to apply both these methods within a single practice. So let's dedicate the merit that we've created to one, generating the mind of enlightenment and bringing about enlightenment for ourselves and all living beings. So please join me in saying, due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. Now, the way to bring this about, of course, is to create a mind of enlightenment, and that's what the next prayer is about. May the supreme jewel, bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. For His Holiness has long life. The wish-granting, wish-fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness in this world, to the incomparably kind Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And finally, the prayer for Rinpoche's swift return. In holding and spinning the Muni's precious and complete teachings for explanation and practice, you wore the armour of patience that is never disparaged. Incomparable, venerable Guru, to you, and make this request.